I want young people all across the South Side of Chicago, all across America, to be able to look at this center and say, this is a sign I count, and this is a sign that I can change the world.
That's former President Barack Obama in Chicago last week, talking about his new presidential center. We'll talk about how it could affect the city's South Side. Plus, the state promised to improve group homes for disabled adults, but allegations of abuse have risen and staffing levels have fallen. Here's a former group home program manager in Champaign speaking with us last summer.
There's not enough money in the budget to be able to overstaff, to be able to plan for having, you know, a really comfortable work environment while you're still filling positions, considering that you're always filling positions.
And five Democrats in the 13th Congressional District want to unseat Republican Rodney Davis. Today, we begin our series of interviews with those candidates, starting with Eric Jones and Dr. David Gill. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Over the past 2 years, the state of Illinois has promised to reform troubled group homes for disabled adults due to allegations of abuse and lack of staff. But despite that, according to a new report from the Chicago Tribune, the allegations have only risen while staff levels continue to fall. We first talked about this issue on the 21st last summer. But since then, some vulnerable adults who have failed to thrive in group homes have been quietly granted admission to a state facility. This marks a dramatic shift in state policy. Joining me to talk about these changes and his longtime reporting in this area is Michael Behrens from the Chicago Tribune. Michael, I want to welcome you back to the 21st.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Michael, so the allegations of abuse and neglect reached a record high last year with more than 3,600 cases in 2017 alone. And you joined us in July to talk about some of those issues confronting those who lived in these homes. But let's take it a step back, remind listeners kind of what's going on here and who ends up being the people who are in these homes.
Well, the genesis goes back to the previous administration and the former Governor Quinn, when the state of Illinois decided they wanted to save money. And one way to do that was to empty the state developmental centers and push or steer people into privately owned group homes. The belief was that many people in institutional care would actually thrive better in group homes, and that they would have more independence and freedom. And in theory and in practice, this is actually a good thing. We want to provide as much freedom and independence to people with disabilities as much as possible. But in Illinois, sadly, as many things, the systems are broken here.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were moving people to group homes, the state didn't want to provide the necessary funding to give the same level of services that the state developmental centers provide into the group homes. And so this created a conundrum, and then this is what caused, you know, the rise in abuse and neglect, is people were being put into group homes, and the homes weren't properly equipped or prepared to deal with people who exhibited severe disabilities or behaviors.
Yeah, and I want to get to one of those particular stories here in just a minute, but talking about these allegations, so they come to light, and the state says, we're going to do something about this. What did they promise to do?
The state promised greater transparency, and which, to their credit, I will say they are working on right now. I've had numerous conversations with the state in the last few days and weeks, and they are getting ready to unveil some major reforms within the next couple of months, which I think will be a huge first step. They're going to try to allow people for the first time to know what kind of allegations are being registered at each of the group homes, something
mm-hmm.
that's nearly impossible to determine now. But, you know, from a concrete point of view, it comes down to money, right? And the state still has not increased, you know, significantly its funding formulas for group homes. There are 3,000 group homes just for adults with disabilities scattered statewide, and many of them are operating on shoestring budgets, and that's just a recipe for disaster.
So we're seeing that there's going to be more money, there's going to be more transparency. That's all a future forward fun or future looking thing. But have they promised things in the past? Because these allegations really started to come to light 2 years ago. And have there been any promises over the past 2 years that have been made, perhaps met or not met?
Well, there have been some promises kept. I think they have done significant reform in the way these investigations are done. We revealed back in late 2016 that the state had actually contracted out investigations to essentially untrained civilians who worked for nonprofit groups, and the quality of those investigations were dubious at best in some cases. So they've hired more investigators. They're doing a better job investigating. While there has been a rising number of allegations of abuse and neglect, that can be attributed in part perhaps to greater public awareness. But the bottom line is that the group homes themselves, when you talk to the owners, they're saying, we are in crisis mode here. We don't have enough money to provide staff. The pay is you know, just incredibly low for these caregivers, mm-hmm. you know, who often make, you know, lower than someone at Walmart's and certainly lower than someone at Amazon. And so the turnover is 50-60% in some of these systems. And so you're getting the lowest trained employee, the lowest paid employee, and there's not enough of them even to go around. It's not unusual to have one person in a home with four, five, even six people with severe disabilities. And how do you watch that many mm-hmm. people? Some of whom need, you know, constant monitoring to be safe.
Well, and Michael, that kind of gets to the story that you shared in some of your recent reporting. It's really emblematic of some of what you've described here. And her name is Marjorie Powers. So could you tell us a little bit more about her story?
You know, Marjorie is just, you know, I think something that many Illinois parents are struggling with. Peggy Strong, who's her mother, mm-hmm. Realized that Marjorie was not thriving in the group home. Marjorie has a number of severe disabilities. She's one of the most, she has, you know, multiple diseases. She has a rare disease. She has muscular dystrophy. She can walk, but she can't feed herself. She has no understanding of what's going on around her. She has pica, which means she'll involuntarily swallow small objects that's within her reach. So she needs constant monitoring. Plus she has, you know, significant medical issues. And in the group home, as her condition worsened, as many people do, you know, no one stays the same. She started going into stage four, you know, diseases. And the doctor that the mother consulted said, you know, she probably has months to live. And, you know, you need to start thinking about hospice. And that's when Peggy wow. started asking around, well, where else can someone help my daughter? Is there mm-hmm. someplace besides a group home? And that's when she discovered there's a place called Murray Developmental Center in Centralia. And she learned this through Representative Terry Bryant, who she consulted. And as you saw perhaps in the story, it's sort of a funny story. And, you know, Peggy is a diehard Democrat. She's never been involved in politics. She's never given a campaign donation. She didn't know Terry Bryant, who's a Republican. But when she went to Terry's office, Peggy said, you know, Terry, they bonded as mothers. And Terry helped her and championed, you know, the search, you know, for a place to help try to keep Marjorie alive. And Murray Developmental Center was that place. And, you know, the conundrum was that the state of Illinois initially said, no, you know, we're not going to let Marjorie just come in.
And so how is Marjorie doing today?
You know, I saw her just a few weeks ago with her mother. She's doing fantastic. Her
Good.
Stage four disease has been put under control. And for the first time, and I guess you would have to have a child, you know, who has disabilities to understand how, you know, seemingly small victory is a major victory.
Yeah.
She could not swallow water before because she would choke potentially fatally. Now she, for the first time, she's able to swallow liquids on her own. And so that's a huge step forward, which means that her body is starting to repair a little bit.
That's great. Michael Behrens is a reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Michael, thank you so much for joining us for this update today on the 21st.
Thank you so much. It's a very important topic. Thanks for tackling it.
We all know that our bodies should be physically fit, but what about our brains? And while it can be hard to get off the couch to get out and physically exercise, you may not have to go too far to get a good brain workout. A recent piece in Chicago Magazine explores four ways to boost your brain, according to research across universities in Illinois. And the key factor for the magazine, how much brain boosting can we get while still being a couch potato? So to find out just how lazy we can remain, we are joined on the line by Chicago Magazine senior editor Lauren Williamson. And Lauren is based in LaGrange, a western suburb of Chicago, and also on the line from Champaign. Payne is Liz Stein Morrow, and she is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois with appointments at the Beckman Institute. Thanks so much for both of you for joining us.
Great
Thank
to be
you
here.
For having
Thanks
me.
For having us.
So, Lauren, I want to start with you. As I mentioned, the magazine rounded up four different studies based on research from around the state. So DePaul, Northwestern, Rush University. So what made you want to tackle this topic of brain boosting?
Well, so much of our quality of life is dependent on how we feel mentally and emotionally. And, you know, if you're just not feeling happy, if your memory is starting to slide, mm-hmm. you just don't feel as good. And so we wanted to look at the whole body in terms of health and focusing specifically this month on the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is so true that we talk so much about like your physical exercise, getting out, walking around, that sort of thing. But we don't think about our largest muscle there, the brain, the most important. So, Liz, why is it important to, or in your perspective, from your perspective of research, why is it important to exercise the brain too?
That's a great question. We used to think that cognition and memory started to, you know, kind of formed, these mental skills were kind of formed early and didn't develop that much past college.
Right.
But now we know the brain is plastic throughout the lifespan. We know that people that are engaged in complex work, stimulating leisure, have rich social networks, are more resilient in the face of brain pathologies later in life. So you can think about all this stimulation as kind of creating a cognitive reserve that protects us. So it's really important to stay active and engaged.
So, Liz, I'm kind of curious along that vein, if you don't use it, will you lose it, so to speak? Is it important to just keep moving it because you'll see some decline?
That's a great question too. I do believe that use it or lose it is a good shorthand, but on the other hand, you want to be careful what you mean by it. Some people think use it or lose it means anything, you know, so video games or whatever, and I don't want to get to that.
We'll get to that here a little bit.
That's the right principle. Yeah. So I'm not sure that that's the principle. I think it's important to think about how you use it and what you're not going to lose. So generally speaking, we are able to do what we keep doing. And so you should maintain the activities that are important to you so that you can continue to do those things.
Well, and Lauren, along what Liz just mentioned there, there are two studies that recommend things that we already think of as pretty healthy stuff, right? So get more exercise and eat well. But the other two recommend activities that we don't necessarily think of as, quote, good behaviors, like playing video games or gossiping. But I want to start with the exercise side of things. Of course, it is good for your body. But what does the study say as far as what it can do to boost your brain?
There is a lot of research. Oh, I'm sorry.
Lauren, we'll go to you first.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. So, so in terms of the exercise, this was a study that was out of Northwestern, and they followed a group of people for 30 years, so from their 20s to their 50s. And they found that people who had better cardiovascular health when they were young adults, then by the time that they checked in with them in their 50s, their brains were actually larger than people who had poor cardiovascular health when they were young. And their brains didn't grow, but they didn't shrink as much, which meant that they had higher cognitive function, they had better memories, and, you know, just all in all, their brains were much healthier. And exercise was just one component of having good cardiovascular health. So, you know, you also shouldn't smoke and eat well and all of that. But regular exercise did play a key role there.
And Liz, did you find that to be true as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of research showing the benefits of physical exercise, aerobic exercise, especially if it's augmented with strength training. It's important to have a healthy body to promote a healthy mind.
I like it. And Lauren, kind of going a little counterproductive of that, your version of thumbs up and thumbs down was a, quote, sloth factor. So could you explain what that means?
Well, we were thinking of a fun way to present this, and also the fact that everyone is so busy. Who wants to add one more thing to do? It's like, oh my gosh, I want to take care of my brain too, but how am I going to fit this into my life? So we kind of wanted to rate things on how lazy you could be and still get some benefit. And so it's just kind of like a fun little approach to it. And obviously exercising is not a lazy thing to do, but you should be doing it anyway. So, you know, breaking a sweat does require effort, but it should be part of your regular routine.
Absolutely. And then, Liz, could you kind of build on that? Where does eating healthy fall into this?
Oh, I think it's, you know, part of the balanced diet of activities and and how to nurture the body to promote good health. There's definitely research that shows that nutrition, good nutrition, is foundational.
Yeah. So are you saying it's just more like that just helps you live a more holistic, balanced, healthy mindset type life? Or is there actually a link to if I eat more kale, my brain's going to function at a higher level?
Oh, I'm not that familiar with the particulars of that research, but I know there's a lot of research about, you know, there is research on micronutrients and the role they play in specific aspects of cognition. So I think there's good research out there, but and we just need to dig into it a little bit more.
And Laura,
yeah, I don't know about kale specifically.
Well, that's just kind of like the healthy mascot,
yeah,
right?
I know. It's easy to go there.
Yeah. And Lauren, in your research for your reporting and things, did you find any links healthy eating there that you'd like to add?
Yeah. There was a Rush University study that came out this fall that looked specifically at kale, among other leafy greens like spinach and lettuce and collard greens. And they found that elderly people who ate at least one serving of leafy greens a day, which is only half a cup for some of those more dense greens like kale or spinach, and a full cup for something a little lighter like lettuce, their cognitive function was equivalent to someone who was about 11 years younger than they
were. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So in that study, they haven't been able to prove a direct link yet, but they have found a correlation that this was a common behavior that people that had they too actually had more gray matter. I'm getting that mixed up with a different study. Scratch that. But
okay.
They did have better cognitive function than people who had a less healthy eating style.
Well, and I'd love to get more into that. We have to take a quick break, but we will continue talking about how you can boost your brain on the 21st. So stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting The Aesthetics of Collective Experience, March 9th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Artist Amanda Browder will discuss her public art project, Chromatopia, and giving voice to a community with collaborative art practices. cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for staying with the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. We are continuing our conversation about brain boosting and what we can do to keep both our bodies and our minds healthy. On the line, we have Chicago Magazine senior editor Lauren Williamson and University of Illinois psychology professor Liz Stein Morrow. And welcome back to continue this conversation. As Lauren was talking about before we took that quick break, the idea of leafy greens and getting those incorporated into your diets, especially for older individuals, might help stimulate the brain and keep that functioning at a higher level. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the bad behaviors side of the research. And by bad behaviors, I mean things that, so, you know, culturally speaking, we as a society, we don't really see as great behaviors like video games, screens, gossiping, that sort of thing. So, Lauren, moving over to this dark side, we've long heard that video games and too much screen time, not really great for us, especially the kids. You want to police that. But can you tell us about the study that you looked into that linked video games with brain boosting?
So there's this lab at DePaul University where students and faculty collaborate on creating games that help people with all sorts of different troubles that they may be experiencing. Some of the games help people navigate having sickle cell disease, for example. But the particular one that we focused on, it helps people deal with their anxiety. And so it's a mental health focus to this game. And people will use an avatar to navigate through different challenges and have to come up against and face certain fears over the course of the game. And then if all goes as planned, then they start to kind of build some confidence and realize that in their real life, they can also face down and tackle these challenges that are giving them severe anxiety.
Okay, so we're talking more like video games that are designed around this idea as opposed to video games, anything you can go buy off the shelf, first-person shooter, et cetera.
Right, yeah. So it's not just like any old video game. It's one that's designed to deal with a specific mental health issue.
Okay, good clarification there. And so, Liz, over to you. What are your thoughts about screen time and how that affects our brain, either positive or negative?
Well, I guess most of the research that's been done on the video game stuff are ones that are designed to improve cognitive performance. And that has, there's been quite a bit of research, and none support the outrageous claims that those kinds of games make. You know, they're going to build your academic performance, improve your work performance, build your social relationships. Like, that's ridiculous. the games that are out of DePaul seem interesting. I think, you know, the fact is that people get anxious in real life social situations. Mm-hmm. So you want to understand. I mean, you got to do the research that really shows the transfer of the gains within the video game to outside the video game. And I don't think that's been accomplished yet, but it's, you know, it's an interesting way to go.
Right. Absolutely. It's an interesting way to work through a problem, or at least a start is what you're saying. But I'm curious, do you find any obvious downfalls to it? So you're saying it may not produce everything it's promising, but do you see any negative reasons for doing it? Or?
Well, I mean, everything we know about what promotes good cognitive health, good mental health, is engagement in real-world activities. Mm. Not to mention the fact that sitting in front of a screen is pretty sedentary. And, you know, you get a lot of exercise just, you know, walking off to go have lunch with your friends. So, it's just that the you know, maybe one of the issues is just the video games and these video platforms are so seductive, and it's easy to sit there for long periods of time without moving, which is really not good. And it creates, you know, it creates the impression or it creates the impression that these are real situations, and they're not that real. And they're not, even though they seem complex, they're not nearly as complex as the work we do every day or the leisure activities or the people that we interact with. So I'm just a little skeptical.
That they can never really replace, you know, they can represent, but they can never replace an actual interaction out in the world is basically kind of what you're getting at there.
Yeah.
So,
you know, some of the research shows that the people that have the biggest cognitive gains through the lifespan or the reduced declines are those that have a diversity of activities.
Okay.
So it's kind of like nutrition, I guess. It's a good analogy, is that, you know, there's not one thing that you eat that's going to make you healthy. Like, for all the benefits of kale, that's not going to be enough. And so some of the video games kind of assume that we've kind of discovered what the magic pill is, you know, that we know all the nutrients for the health, you know, healthy mind, and they're going to distill it down into this product. And it's just, it's like with vitamins. We know that, you know, vitamins are absorbed better into the system if they're accompanied by fats and proteins. And so it's kind of, we're built to live in the ecology of the real world. And I think we just have to be a little bit I'm wary of the claims that we've kind of dialed it all into a computer program.
Well, and speaking of getting out into the real world, kind of having real interactions with people, Lauren, the last piece of the research that the magazine included is one you dubbed Gossip with Pals. And again, gossiping is not something that we necessarily see as, quote, good for us. But why might this be good for our brains, according to these researchers at Northwestern?
Well, this was actually my favorite of the studies. They looked at a group of people who are known as super agers. And so these are people who are in their 80s and 90s and have the cognitive function of someone who's in their 50s or 60s.
Okay.
And gossiping with pals for us is kind of a shorthand for having like really kind of close, warm, engaging social relationships with people, which this study found that was a key part of super agers' lifestyles. That they have a really good network of friends that they can go to on a regular basis, that they feel support them and that they feel equally supportive of. So it's a, you know, very reciprocal, dear friendship. And This is the one where they actually did have more gray matter than their peers who didn't have as many close relationships. So their brains were actually larger. And just like with the exercise study, their brains didn't grow, but they didn't shrink as rapidly as people who didn't have these very supportive, nurturing relationships.
Well, Liz, we just have about a minute left, but I want to stay with this super ager group, this older generation group, and get your perspective on how we should approach brain health and brain boosting at different ages. Are there different approaches to that?
Well, you know, I think early in life, it's a little bit easier to stay engaged. I mean, we go to school and we go to work. We have these social structures in place. And I think we, you know, older ages are kind of young in our culture, and we don't really know how to be old yet, and we're trying to figure this out. So we have some great resources here in Champaign-Urbana. So the OLLI program, OSHA Lifelong Learning, is a great, you know, it's school for people over 50. I totally echo what Laura said about warm, rich social relationships and networks, is that that's really, really important. So, I mean, I think it's just important for us to figure out at every age where's our sweet spot to stay engaged, to stay to engage in rich mental and social activity without getting overwhelmed, without getting stressed. So you don't want to do it so much. You don't want to have so many activities that you're really stressed, but you want to have enough activities that you enjoy and that you find stimulating.
It definitely seems like it's all about balance. We will tweet out a link to Chicago Magazine's wrap-up of local brain research. I want to thank senior editor Lauren Williamson and University of Illinois psychology professor Liz Stein-Morrow. You guys have been great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Last year, former President Barack Obama unveiled plans to build the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park on the south side of Chicago in partnership with the University of Chicago. It's a little different from the presidential libraries of years past. The plans include an auditorium, educational spaces, a public garden, and all of this is expected to bring a lot of construction and development to Jackson Park. But some residents are worried and skeptical that this plan is good for the neighborhood. Local community activists have been pushing for written agreements that the center will in fact employ people who live in the area. And recently, 200 faculty members at the University of Chicago signed a letter that criticized the plans for this new center. In a public meeting last week, the former president pushed back against some of these criticisms. And he also said that he wants the new Obama Center to be an inspiration to young people.
20 years from now, 30 years from now, I want young people all across the south side of Chicago, all across America, to be able to look at this center and say, this is a sign I count, and this is a sign that I can change the world.
That's audio from the Obama Foundation. Lolly Bowen is reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune, and she joins me now on the line. Lolly, I want to welcome you to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Lolly, so we get that the most recent public meeting, we're going to get to the most recent public meeting we just heard from in a minute, but I want, for those of us who don't live in the Chicago area, to have you give us a sense of how the Obama Center is going to look and how the neighboring and surrounding area is going to look.
Well, right now, the center is proposed for Jackson Park. It's a park area that is kind of forgotten about, but it's tucked away behind the Museum of Science and Industry near the Chicago lakefront, and it's in close proximity to the Hyde Park community. So it's a little bit across one of the major streets here and gives a view of the skyline and a view of the beautiful lakefront.
And sticking with the logistics here for a moment, where is the money for the building of this center coming from? Is it mostly from the foundation, or will there be public contribution as well?
The majority of funding for construction of the center is coming from the foundation itself, and they are in the process of raising that money. They estimate that the cost will be more than $500 million total. They've already awarded the first contract for construction management, which was valued at $300 million. And former President Barack Obama has reminded us during his visits that he is out actively fundraising and campaigning in order to pull in the dollars to pay for the center. But one of the things that has been noted among residents here is that some of the money will actually come from taxpayer dollars. There's some infrastructure improvements that have to be made, some changes to streets and roadways, to some overpasses in the park, and all of that has to be paid for through state and city dollars. And I think it's estimated at like $180 million worth of improvements.
So, Lolly, last summer we spoke with the director of Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, and he told us that one of the biggest concerns for him has to do with the housing prices. And he said that this, you know, big new center will drive up rent and property taxes, possibly push out lower income and working class families that are already living on the South Side. So do you find that to be an accurate way to describe the concerns of the residents?
Well, there are different groups that are raising questions about this new development. And a lot of the residents do have housing on the forefront of their minds. There is a movement in Chicago now to draw attention to increasing rent and increasing housing prices throughout the city. And there's a national movement that is asking our elected officials and government officials to really take a close look at how much people are paying for housing, because there's such a growing number of working residents who are paying more than half of their income toward housing. So there is some legitimate concern about how the development is going to impact this community, not just Hyde Park, but the surrounding neighborhoods in the entire South Side.
So what has President Obama and the Obama Foundation said in response to some of these concerns that we've already talked about today?
Well, I think one of the surprises when President Obama showed up at his public meeting last week is that he decided to address these concerns directly. And he talked about how residents can be nervous about gentrification and that he understands why residents would be concerned about the rising cost of rent or property taxes. But what he emphasized is that with this development, he hopes to essentially provide jobs and increase the economic opportunities so that residents can have jobs close by that pay a living wage and so that they can afford the changes that come as a result of this development.
So to sum up what we've been talking about, you know, it really seems like on one hand, President Obama is saying that this center will be an important source of economic development for Jackson Park neighborhood, and also telling those who live there, hey, you matter, I care about you, and I care about this area. And while on the other hand, some are saying that the gains from this development might in fact not benefit those who are living there and could push them out. So we've talked about that. But do you have a clear sense at this time who's right on this issue, or is this just a we have to wait and see how it plays out?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a wait and see how it plays out situation. What I would like to say, though, is that, you know, the foundation has engaged residents and their concerns, and they have you know, through his appearance, he did address gentrification in a way that I don't think we've seen as a city before. So the idea that he has at least spoken to displacement and that he is hearing the concerns kind of signals that maybe there's something to come, or that it is at least on the or it's at least a part of the conversation.
Lolly Boween is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Lolly, thanks so much for joining us for this update today.
Thank you for having me.
As always, we'd love to hear from you on Friday. Nyla will be joined by foodies Monica Ang and Luis Chu for a celebration of Chinese restaurants here in Illinois. So we want to know, what's your favorite Chinese restaurant in your area of the state? Leave us a voicemail, share your pick and why, and we can play it on the air. You can call 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. And coming up after the break, we've been interviewing candidates ahead of what's already been a very busy election season. This week, we're airing interviews with five Democrats who want to represent Illinois' 13th district in the House of Representatives. And today, we're starting with Eric Jones and Dr. David Gill. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Illinois' 13th Congressional District is represented right now in Washington by Rodney Davis. He's not facing a primary challenger from his own party, but on the Democratic side, five people are vying to face off against him after the March 20th primary, and we're talking to all of them. The district covers all or part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois, including Bloomington, Urbana, and Springfield. Today, Eric Jones is an attorney from Edwardsville. He's been a past assistant Illinois attorney general and has also worked in Congress as a chief investigative counsel. He spoke with Nyla Boodoo last week. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So this is an election year where a lot of Democrats are saying they want to run for governor, for attorney general. Last time around, Rodney Davis just had one opponent. Why are you running against him to represent the 13th district now?
Yeah, sure. A couple things. Look, you know, I have two young sons, and my wife and I were very concerned about the direction that our country's headed. And our young boys, when they're old enough to understand, they're 5 and 2 now, we wanted to tell them that their mom and dad did everything they possibly could to change the direction of the country. And for us, it meant jumping into this campaign and trying to flip the 13th district and flip the House. And I have a long history of background working in government. I was a former Illinois Assistant Attorney General, as you mentioned, and also worked in Congress. I've been fighting for people throughout my career, and I think this district deserves someone who's willing to fight for them and who will focus on issues that matter to them. I've taken on special interests, and I've taken on a government that's not working, and I think we need a member of Congress who can do that.
You said that fighting for the economic future of this district would be your number one priority. How would you plan to achieve that?
Yeah, sure. There's a number of things we can be doing that we're not doing. Most significantly, we need to be investing in our infrastructure, which we have not done. Number two, this district has more universities in it, I believe, than any other congressional district in the country. And what I've seen in recent years is an abandoning the investment we should be making in our universities and our colleges and our junior colleges. And the United States government needs to reinvest in its people. And the one huge way of doing that is by investing in its universities. And, you know, today we're in Champaign, and the University of Illinois is one of the flagship universities we have in the country, and it's known throughout the world, and we need to be investing in it properly. And I haven't seen that happen enough. And I haven't seen Rodney Davis fight enough for this university or the other universities in the district. And then finally, one point that I've been talking about a lot on this campaign is something called rural broadband. And if you pull the statistics from the Federal Communications Commission, there are over 200,000 people in the counties that make up this district that do not have access to basic high-speed internet. And when we are now facing a digital economy and we are being forced as consumers and as students and as individuals to go more and more online to do just basic tasks, the fact that we have 200,000 people in this area who don't have access to basic high-speed internet and cannot do that is unacceptable. So I think that's something we need to be fighting for on day one in Congress. And, you know, I've been saying this on the campaign trail for a while, and I have people come back to me and say, well, how are we going to do this? How are you going to get that done? And this is what I say. You know, in the 1930s, we had the same problem in this country with electrification, and rural communities did not have access to electricity. Well, the federal government stepped forward, created the REA, created the co-op system, and now we take electricity for granted. We can do the same thing when it comes to the basic high-speed internet.
Do you feel like the issue of net neutrality will be further harmful to people in rural areas?
When I worked in the Illinois Attorney General's office and when I worked in Congress, I was an advocate on protecting net neutrality. Net neutrality is the way the internet we have known has grown up, and people have asked me, well, what is net neutrality, right? I got that question a lot. It's the idea that a company, your cable company or your internet provider cannot decide which websites you get to go to and which websites you can't go to. And it also ensures that if you're a small business and you want to be on the internet, they can't pick and choose winners and losers. If a internet provider wants to offer a service that would compete with you as a small business, they can't decide, well, we're going to make sure that small business can't get in here. That's the way the internet has always worked. And that's why it's gone really well. Getting rid of net neutrality is like allowing your electricity company to decide what appliances you get to plug into your outlets. And we have to really fight against that. And I've been against it from day one. And, you know, all consumers pretty much agree that we need net neutrality. And it's another example where our current representative voted against it. I think that's very harmful. And I would get to Congress and I would fight against I would fight for protecting it.
I'm speaking with Eric Jones. Eric, we've heard a lot of conversation about immigration, so I'll just ask you very simply, do you think there should be more immigration or less to this country?
Oh, immigration is what this country is built upon, so I'm very supportive of immigration. I mean, I, you know, this this Everyone who's here has immigrated here for the most part, big chunks of our population. And this notion that we're going to turn our backs to the thing that has made us the successful country that we are, I think is really the wrong approach. Absolutely.
We've seen high school students all over the country and here in Illinois demanding political change in regards to what they say are common sense gun control laws, but we've seen very little action on that front for years. What do you think should be done at the federal level to prevent mass shootings?
There are a number of things I think most people in this country want right now. And I've been saying this since day one when I got into this race. And the reason why we're not seeing movement is because of the gun lobby. And I connect it to the work that I've done on all these other issues, whether it's on insurance or protecting against or combating climate change or ensuring that we have investments in our people and not in, in other things. And the issue is special interests. And the reason why we're not moving on that issue is because of special interests. And what I advocate for is we need universal background checks. We need to ban bump stocks, which I can't believe those things haven't been banned yet. We also need to get military-grade weapons like AR-15s off the streets. We need to put a ban on the sale of those as well. I just saw this morning Dick's Sporting Goods came out and supported all this and also said they're going to stop selling it. And I think that kind of movement and the grassroots movement and the students who are out there are going to continue, and we're going to make sure we get people in Congress who are willing to do something about it. And I sincerely hope that the tide is beginning to turn on this issue.
So the 13th District is an interesting shape. If you look at it on the map, it goes as far north as Bloomington, east to Urbana, south as Edwardsville, and west to the Missouri border. What's your favorite place to visit in the district?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a tough question. I got to tell you, I'm in Champaign, Champaign-Urbana. I love coming here because of the university town. It's fun to come here. And we've been spending a lot of time here. I've been here for the last 4 or 5 days. I love checking out the restaurants here when we have a moment for lunch. I'll tell you, it's also been nice to go to, parts of the district that are along the Mississippi River are very pretty, very rural. And I've had a good time in Bloomington with Illinois State there as well. You're trying to pin me down on a favorite.
I'll give you a few.
How's that?
You're not going to pick one. Okay. It's Eric Jones. He's an attorney from Edwardsville, a past Illinois Assistant Attorney General. He also worked in Congress as a chief investigative counsel. Eric, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for the time.
Another candidate for the 13th Congressional District is David Gill. He's an emergency room doctor who primarily practices in Gibson City. This is his sixth time running for congressional office. Dr. Gill, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is an election year where lots of Democrats are getting involved in races, whether it's for governor, for attorney general. Last time around, Rodney Davis just had one opponent. But as I mentioned, this is your sixth attempt running for office. Why now?
Because we need a new House Democratic majority, and part of that majority can be Illinois 13 if we have the right messenger with the right message to run against Rodney Davis. You allude to the fact that I've run several times. Three of those races were in an old Illinois 15 that was widely regarded as hopeless, where a Democrat is supposed to lose by 50 points. And so those runs were not undertaken with the hope of winning. I did that to provide a voice to those who felt so voiceless while represented by former Representative Tim Johnson. I did run one time here in Illinois 13 in 2012 and came within 0.3 points of defeating Rodney Davis. And the voters had the misfortune that year of having a liberal independent on the ballot who was expressing all of the same views as myself with regards to campaign finance reform and climate change and gay marriage and single-payer health care, and a woman's right to choose. And that individual took a little more than 7 points. My message won by 7 points that year, but Mr. Davis, because the vote got split just enough, went to Washington by 0.3 point. So this would be my second run here in Illinois 13. And I've been watching since 2012, and I've seen subsequent Democrats lose by 18 points, by 20 points. They lose by 50 to 60 times what I lost by. And I think that given the necessity of winning this to have a majority that which will stand up against the man occupying the White House, it's really incumbent upon me to make this attempt to be a part of that majority.
Dr. Gill, as I mentioned, you're an emergency room physician. You said your first priority, if elected, would be health, reforming our health system. Now that the individual mandate has been repealed, how do you plan to go about doing that?
Well, Nyla, for 25 years, I've been saying the same thing about healthcare, and that is that we desperately need a single-payer healthcare system, and we need it right now. It's not something that can be put off any longer. I joined a group 25 years ago called Physicians for a National Health Program. We're 20,000 doctors who advocate for single-payer, improved Medicare for all, because every day that goes by, we have an American dying every 15 minutes just because they have the wrong kind of insurance. It galls me. I watch it in my ER. I watch the suffering and the occasional dying just because of the way that we finance healthcare in this country. 100 Americans dying every day over this. And so I think that single payer is the way to go. And the public has come around to that as well. When I joined PNHP 25 years ago, single payer polled at about 20%. Now 60% of Americans want to see a single payer healthcare system. 60% of doctors want to see a single payer healthcare system. And I think we're on the cusp of getting it done. And I think one of the best things that we can do to achieve that here in Illinois 13 is to send a progressive physician such as myself to Washington to serve as a healthcare champion to help put the ball over the finish line, so to speak.
One of the other issues we've heard a lot of discussion about over the past year is immigration. And so I wanted to ask you a very simple question about this. Do you think there should be more immigration or less immigration to the United States?
I think more immigration is always good. I think allowing this country to fully flourish involves having people from a wide variety of backgrounds and cultures. I think that's what our American history is. We are a nation of immigrants. And I think that this whole attitude of talking about making borders more secure and throwing people out that have lived here for many years and turning our backs on 800,000 young people who have done nothing wrong and who have always called America their home. These are unwise, unsafe, and bigoted attitudes, frankly.
We're seeing high school students, you mentioned the Dreamers, we're seeing high school students all over the country and here in Illinois demanding political change in regards to what they say are common sense gun control laws. With the exception of the past couple of days, there hasn't really been very much action on this front, certainly at the federal level. We're seeing some movements now in the Illinois State House. I want to ask you about the federal level. What do you think should be done to prevent mass shootings?
A great deal. This is something I'm very passionate about, Nyla, because working in an emergency department, I have the misfortune of seeing victims of gun violence. And there's nothing more gut-wrenching than having to look a mother in the eyes and tell her that her child has been shot to death. And so for a long time, I've been arguing for increased gun control measures, including the banning of assault weapons. You know, I think that we had a ban like that in place until 2004, and it served us very well, and I think that we should return to that. I support a national gun registry. I support mandatory background checks on each and every purchase with no loopholes and no exceptions. Yeah, certainly, we need to ban the bump stocks that we saw featured in Las Vegas. So there are many, many things that we can do. And, you know, the public broadly wants to see those things done. Surveys show that 80% of Americans want these types of common sense reforms, but we have too many representatives like Rodney Davis who has received $45,000 from the NRA who sit on their hands and don't bring us these common sense gun reforms. I thought that surely last summer that might be his moment to shine when he was involved in a shooting in Alexandria, Virginia. I thought that perhaps he might sense that this was a moment where he could do the right thing. And I've been surprised at his lack of activity on necessary gun reforms.
Last question. We just have less than a minute left. But if you look at the 13th District, it's a pretty interesting shape when you look on the map, from Bloomington to Urbana to Edwardsville, west to the Missouri border. What's your favorite place to visit in the 13th District?
Oh, that's impossible, Nyla. I like them all.
No one wants to answer this question.
No, I mean, because there's so many great places. I mean, a lot of the small towns in between the places that you mentioned are wonderful places. And I'll tell you what, they're all filled with good people. I take care of these people in the emergency department. I've worked in Bond County and Madison County and DeWitt County, in addition to McLean and Champaign counties in their emergency departments. And there are a lot of good people who have been misrepresented for a long, long time, and I look forward to serving as their congressman. It's been a pleasure to be a physician for them. It's been a pleasure to be the assistant director of the Illinois Department of Public Health for them, but I think they need far better representation in Washington.
Dr. David Gill, as you've just heard him say, is an emergency room doctor who primarily practices in Gibson City. He's one of five Democrats running for the 13th Congressional District against, and the winner, of course, will face off against Rodney Davis. The primary is on March 20th. Dr. Gill, thanks for being with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're speaking with two more Democratic candidates for the 13th Congressional District. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.